Welcome to the J3 University Podcast. I'm your host, John Jewett.
And I'm your co-host, Luke Miller.
Our mission is to elevate the physique coaching standard
and deliver the highest level of competitors to the stage.
Let's jump into today's episode. Building the ultimate X-frame. I can't help but after watching the Olympia weekend, look at the massive X-frame that we just saw win the Olympia, and congratulations out to Derek Lunsford in his Olympia win and setting history with also becoming the first person to win in two divisions, 212 and open. And Derek has quite the tremendous X-frame. And so Luke and I wanted to dive into, in your program design, what should be some focal points for building out the ultimate X-frame, which we see really span across almost every division. You need some degree of X-frame outside of, like, you know, wellness or something. That's like a, do we call that an A-frame? I don't know. But for the vast majority, we want to focus on how training design should be programmed for a generalized X-frame build. So focusing on 4 points of waist, quads, lats, delts, and we're going to break those down for you.
Yeah, I think for the newer audience, they may not know who this is, but I tend to think of like a Tony Freeman when I think X-frame, like throwing it back to someone like that. And like, what are the big highlights that really make an X-frame, right? It's going to be massive delts to set the top portion of the frame, lats to tie in the delts into the waist, abs, not only from a waist size, but I think there's an ab development portion to be discussed within that conversation that can really help tie a physique together. And then obviously quads and adductors to help with that quad sweep to bring that X-frame back out. And so as we start to build this out of, like, you may have things that are more priority than others, but just as a general overview of program design is going to have these tenets to make sure you have this X-frame. And then I think there's potentially some discussion about things that people don't do in off season that could change the way their X-frame is on stage. In fact, to the point that I just had a conversation with a client an hour and a half ago about this. So I'm really excited to dive in. I think the direction of the sport is heading into this, and this is what you need in order to succeed. And you don't have to be 275, 280 on stage in the open class, right? So I think it's a very valuable and pertinent discussion to have with the direction the sport's heading.
Yeah, even with our two new, like, you know, Keon winning 212, congrats to him as well. We have Derek and Keon are very similar physiques in the fact that, you know, they vacuum, have small waists, and have this beautiful flow to their physique. So the great champions to have as the representative standard of what we want to see. And within some of these classes and how you present your physique can also accentuate that X-frame, which and you kind of go pose by pose, like what makes up the X-frame within those. And maybe for a front double, the arms could really draw some attention. I kind of think of Michael Crizzo, right? His arms are so big that it ends up making him have this pretty dramatic X-frame because of that level of development. Now, however, or even bring up Phil Heath in like a most muscular, not the most, the widest clavicle guy, but his triceps were so big, that was like his widest point in some of his like most muscular shots. But I don't think that should be a prioritization overall for someone until like you're getting to that higher level. Cause for the majority of what we're looking for, we're talking large amounts of stage weight to really fill out a frame. We want our real big ticket items. So I think you brought up, Luke, the midsection, and when we look at someone, usually you look from kind of the center out and at that silhouette. I think the midsection can highlight a physique really well. We can start there. I think there's things that we want to jump to development-wise first, like quads and back. But if the midsection goes, without thought, it's easy in the off season, like you mentioned, probably is what you're mentioning and alluding to, that could dramatically impact and offset your great quad development or lat development that you built out. So a few things here. For one, your hip structure, rib cage structure is going to be the large determinant of your waist size, and we can't really get too much beyond that. That try to shrink beyond that, you just really can't. Like, that's going to be the limiting factor around that. Now, can you actually shrink the waist? Well, again, structurally, you're going to have those limitations. I like to think you can train the waist to have better control at maintaining within your structural ability. And what we see is people lose that ability to keep the waist trained. And then we see that exposed on stage. Now, we have to have kind of this balance of, like, as we're building out an X frame to increase the taper, and it's okay for the waist to increase to a certain degree. This is going to happen when you're having, say, an open bodybuilder move up from whatever, like, hey, Derek. Derek was I saw him compete at Nationals, USA's, as a middleweight. I'm sure he's like low 230s now. So you're talking, I don't know, say 50 to 60 pounds of stage weight. Your waist size is absolutely going to increase. However, it's been offset by the dramatic exponential increase in lat, delt, quad development. So there's a balancing point where the scale might tip to when you're getting too big. And that's kind of the, at least some of the thoughts around how big to go before it's too big. Now, I guess reeling that back in, well, what should you actually do to really highlight this point of the waist? And I think it begins with training the waist in general, because a lot of people don't have the best control or ability to know how to even contract your obliques or your rectus abdominis correctly, or control your TVA. So one thing I would program in, and I kind of start off this beginning of the day, would be like fasted to where you're going to have the smallest waist possible and doing daily abdominal vacuum work. And you're like, well, John, I can't do an abdominal vacuum. I don't know how to do that. Well, now it's time to learn, because I didn't know how to either, and I've developed that skill. And I would encourage you to check out our applied hypertrophy optimization, because we literally teach you how to do it in there. And off YouTube, or if you're listening on Spotify or something, it's simply too hard to instruct. But that's what I would say, is like every morning, you can take one morning off, but this is your ritual. You do your abdominal vacuum works, you blow out all your everything you got in a slight crunched over position, and then you try to pull that belly button to your spine and the suck up into the rib cage, your abdominal, and hold it as long as you can. Then bring that back down to, like, when you see someone do an overhead ab and thigh contraction, right? They contract down, and what I cue to help people understand how to contract your obliques and even your abs, for one, you could just do like abdominal rope crunch. That could give you some cueing, or even grabbing the side of a table and doing a side bend and having to push into that side of the table, and that will contract that oblique. And essentially what you're trying to do to really contract in that waist is, as you're blowing out your air, you're contracting in your obliques and your rectus abdominis, and that should just really compact your waist. So that's the routine in the morning for the X frame to begin, is abdominal vacuums followed by supersetting these basically with abdominal contractions, and this moving back and forth between the two. And I would say do that for 10 sets every morning would be a great start.
Yeah. It's funny how similarly we think, because when I think abs, I, from a conceptual standpoint for clients to understand, I break it into three components. So structural is component one. Don't really have much control over that. Potentially maybe like, you know, breathing and working on diaphragm control can help some, but not too much control over that. Secondarily would be breath control, which is kind of what you're talking about with being able to do vacuums, breath control on stage in between transition shots, as that's going to be a part of the midsection that's judged. The tertiary component that I break it down into is development. And development to me is the piece that ties it all together with the shots that you're actually displaying the abs fairly prominently. Because breath control, a lot of time, will take care of the waist in like a front double. It'll take care of the waist in a front lat spread for a lot of people. But when you start to look at like an ab and thigh, for most people and most muscular, even like some of the side shots, like a side chest and a side tricep, that's going to be largely development based. And so I break development into four categories with an asterisk next to one of them. First category is going to be like leg raises, like so moving pelvis towards rib cage, in whatever variation that looks like for the athlete, that they can activate Rectus abdominis the best. Secondary is going to be crunch variation of rib cage to pelvis. Third is going to be plank, which is going to be breath control based and being able to maintain a position with breathing intact. So this is going to help a lot with not only bracing and training, but it's also going to help with holding an ab and thigh on stage, in my opinion. And then holding a most muscular on stage, anything where you're pulled down into that ab. And the fourth one, I lumped this into ab work, is rotation work. And it's the one that has the asterisks next to it because I do rotation work for access, not for development. So I do it for like thoracic rotation and things like that and being able to present those side shots. But I lump it into midsection because to me, like that whole integration of spine, rib cage, midsection development is all sequenced together. So that's my four categories to help people conceptually understand like not only what makes ab control on stage, but from a development standpoint, what needs to be ticked box wise from a program perspective.
For your thoracic rotation work, what does that exercise look like?
It's kind of based off how remedial the client is. Like I've had some bodybuilders who've never done a rotation thing in their life, and you could literally stick them in like a thread the needle, and they can't even like get past their other arm without letting hips and other side rotate open to all the way. So that can be one. I really like the one that we demonstrate in AHO against the wall, like the kneeling against the sidewall into like breath control as you rotate. That to me is my go-to, but there's some development and like remedial versions of that that sometimes is needed before someone can actually do that variation. But those are my two go-tos as far as like an extremely remedial version versus like something a little bit more advanced.
You ever have any of those loaded?
I've done like passive loading into thoracic rotation. So something pulling an athlete in thoracic rotation as they move along, trying to reach end ranges they haven't experienced before. But I actually don't load them concentrically, like forcing an athlete into concentric rotation.
Yeah. So, I think that's one that probably doesn't need to happen just for the needs. And again, what we're programming here is like, what's the needs basis of a bodybuilder? Because some other athlete's going to look at what we do and just laugh because you're so unfunctional. But with gaining, getting forced a little bit more into that thoracic rotation, like we talked about, this could be like, you know, a kneel on the against the wall, one arm's kind of pushing you against that rotation, then hold it on your own before going back the other way. So that's just like an isometric, you know, contraction needing to hold that new range, and then you could gain more access over time, right? So I think you could even add this into some of your morning work if you needed to, or your pre-posing work in the morning. And there's one, the McGill Big Three. There's a lot of people have, and it's great. It's great for just overall lower back health, but it teaches a lot of good things. Y'all can look that up if you'd like to. And maybe that even might be prior to doing your abdominal vacuum work. And then even adding in these thoracic rotations also prior to doing your posing work. But the McGill Big Three, it does has some planks, side planks that you need to do to understand breathing and bracing and those contractions, a bird dog, and then just a rectus abdominis contraction. So you can incorporate these in a few different ways. I have been doing the McGill Big Three and thoracic rotations prior to like the morning pose work. So I have like quality posing during it, but I think even doing some of a little bit of that prior to your sessions would be perfectly acceptable too. Now I'm going to bring this back quickly because we don't want to just a whole waste training session, right? And not get into our other movements, but train the abs. Same application as training any muscle group when you need development to take place. So these are going to be, you know, similar volume recommendations, rep range recommendations, in proximity to failure as any other muscle group that we would talk about. So if you need to develop the abs, that would still apply, which a lot of times we're looking at, you know, 8 to 12 sets across the week as you start out. That could even build up into like that to where you're getting into that 12 to 20 set range if you really have higher development needs. And know, that's would be primarily for your rectus abdominis work, like what Luke is talking about, the sternum to pelvis work. So we'll cut it off there, because otherwise we're not going to get to our other muscle groups, let's go down to the hardest one, probably development wise, quads. But we see more people with upper body cartoon syndrome than being lower body dominant, being the male wellness competitor, right? So quad development, and with adding more quad sweep on, you'll hear judges say you need to add more quad sweep. And well, okay. And I've had clients like, hey, John, what exercise is going to hit my quad sweep more? And I wouldn't focus around that, because what you end up doing when you pick exercises to try to really bias towards the quad sweep. And why I say bias is because the knee is a hinge joint, right? So it just bends only one way. And to prioritize a section of the quad is extremely challenging when you're dealing with only a hinge joint. So you're really the key is you just really want to make your quads as big as possible and not get in a position that doesn't allow you to output at a high degree, to where you end up limiting loading maybe, or limiting training effort and not giving that high quality stimulus on a per set basis. Another thing is range of motion, because some people want to buy a certain muscle group and you could do it, but you might be limiting your range of motion when we know getting to those long muscle links really has a great stimulus component for hypertrophy. So the key in this overall quad growth is setting up your movement patterns to get the largest range of motion out of your quad that you can actively control, and being able to, in a stable position, where you can output with a high enough effort level and reaching proximity to failure. And those are really your big ticket items around quad growth. Now, we have a bunch of movement patterns to choose kind of around that, but I think that should be, when you're looking at quad movements, these are things to big ones to consider. I'm trying to get my calf to my hamstring as much knee bend as possible. What movement's going to allow me to do that, and also brace efficiently to do that as well?
Yeah, the stability component of being able to output, because you see like hack squats are great quad builder, and then people are in there in a hack like heels coming up like 3 inches off the platform because they just can't even dorsiflex and or rotate the femur enough to get into that depth, right? So that's like the third thing, is like being able to efficiently keep foot pressure midfoot while you're kind of driving into that depth. That might require adjustments for whatever squat pattern you choose. But when we look at development, foot pressure is going to largely bias depth, in that your ability to stay stable in depth in the bottom position is largely dependent upon where that foot pressure is. I've seen quad development massively change just by helping people click that light bulb, in that we need to put ourselves in positions that allow for driving force into that midfoot while we hit the bottom position. And they get deeper within all their quad based patterns, and they learn to actually control the bottom position, which for me, when we talk about depth and reaching like lengthened tissues, I think that's a big mistake made within quad development when trying to develop an X-frame. Is speed into the hole and then hips moving is like a big one that I see just keep people from developing the quads they're capable of. It's like, even you'll even see it with like a hack. You'll see them go into that bottom with such speed, they go into pelvic tilt that moves that knee joint away from actual quad tension. So I think it's the third component of that quad development, stability with embracing as much knee over toe and or depth slash hamstring to calf as possible, and then foot pressure to create the stability for force output, are the three big ticket items. And just picking exercises you can do that well in.
Yeah, and even within all that, you have like the journey of the rep, right? So you can pick maybe that's a fourth point around this, but I see like you get the right setup, you get the right initial, maybe pressure and bracing, et cetera. But what you're talking about also is that cadence, some people speed through and lose some of that control in part of the lift. So from point A to point B matters a lot. And that's what kind of Luke is talking to. Some of this cueing, you used to be, you know, weight on your heels when you squat, and the squat could look relatively the same, but you're also not, when you do preferentially put some pressure into that kind of that big toe, you do shift some of the forces more onto the quad than the glute. You can become a very glute dominant like squatter, just always having that back heel pressure. So anyway, within quads, pick some movements that are going to train the full function of the quad. So you'll have like some type of squat pattern. A leg press is usually going to be in there, a leg extension. And then I would definitely encourage some type of unilateral pattern, a single leg pattern. Now, this is where I'm going to have a caveat around it's, you know, training the quad sweep, is that if you look at some of those vastus lateralis quad fibers of the quad sweep, whatever you want to call it, they're not just straight up and down from the hip to the knee. Like some are at diagonals and angling out. So if you, and they attach like kind of within that IT band area too. So if that foot moves across more to the midline, so let's say you're on a leg press, you have both feet on the platform at hip width. We took one of those legs and move it to the center of the platform. You could put a little bit extra lengthening bias into that vastus lateralis. Now with your single leg work, usually you're going to have to do that to balance your center of mass. So in turn, your single leg movements might have a bit of bias in the quad sweep. Now, this isn't my thing of like, you should make do all your single leg movements like that if you want quad sweep, but I'm just putting emphasis that, hey, having some single leg work will tick that box. It could be a single leg press, or I would say having some type of split squat in the week would be a good idea. Also, it's going to challenge some of your functional aspects you're going to need as a bodybuilder for hip stability. So for bringing up this overall X frame, for most people, you're going to be doing legs with a quad priority. So most of your big quad movement twice a week, and having that preferentially to where your quad work is first in the day. For the most part, you're looking at usually program like a ham curl first. And then from there, we hit most of the quad work, and then you might go back to a ham curl, or that might end the session. Then you have your second leg session for the week. That's quads.
You move up to lats here because that's the next body part up. And for me, I think of, most people think X frame from the front, right? Like that's the first thing they think of, is like a front lat spread or a front double or even a front relaxed. I think the missing component of an X frame as well is like lat development, not only separating from the waist to make the visual of like the X coming into tying into the waist well, but from the rear, like there is such a thing as having an X frame from the rear too, that's not really discussed as much. And lat development is a huge part of that. I think rear delt kind of plays into that too, but we'll get to that when we get to delts. In that the priority within that is going to allow the X frame to be carried not only from the front, but into the rear shots is really separate yourself. I think of Derek. Like, look at Derek when he turns around and he hits that back double. It is wild how much back development, just from like dense tissue, but also like how it comes into his waist to actually kind of set him up for being able to look wider than some of those guys on stage. Like at 230, he's not outmassing many of those guys. We're assuming low 230s, right? But he visually does because of that X frame illusion. And so, man, lat development and lat fibers and aligning those, we've done ad nauseum and from a content perspective. And so we have so much on that. But I think priority within training lats and understanding that the volume lats can handle due to the exercise selection that's required to be able to train them, I would argue is slightly higher than the average body part because of the loading parameters within movements that you're choosing to train those fibers.
Yeah. So to make that
with a bow on it, tidy for the audience.
Yeah. I didn't want to say it like that. I just to give some clarity around there, like with back training on a per set basis, right? We don't load the muscle very lengthened. It's usually a lot of short end work, right? Your rows are really hard at the when you squeeze the muscle, right? So usually you're failing before you are really loading a lot of these hard lengthens, which cause a lot of tissue damage. But also that's where you get a lot of your stimulus. So I think that's a big reason why you might be able to get more volume to back, and to help like with programming around this. And the idea for back is, And essentially, a lot of people for this type of programming, I would be training like probably back twice a week, legs get hit twice a week, and some level of push twice a week. And that might not be just a 7-day split, guys. This could be 8 or 9 days just based on your recovery ability. But I would have lats prioritized first within that session. So something pulling from overhead, because that's going to be the big ticket for you to get wide. And another point of what Luke is bringing up, for one, is there are a lot of angles to be able to hit fully the back. You don't have to do them all in one session. You could divide them across your sessions. And even with that, you could do multiple sets for an exercise. So don't get stuck in a mindset that if I'm only do 2 sets for my chest press, I can only do 2 sets for my pull down. When if your back is able to handle more volume, maybe you're doing 3 or 4 sets. I also see a benefit if time efficiency is a point for you in back training, is that doing just partials to continue a set would be the point where we train to failure, where I would be more comfortable with back for sure, because we see that recoverability. So if you're doing a pull down and you just can't get it down quite all the way, I think that's okay to do a few extra ones and load that LinkedIn portion to gain the benefit of loaded lengthens, and just like you are out of some of your other movements that are easily done by their loading parameters. So that's essentially how I would program just your to prioritize lat. Lat would get trained first on back day, and picking like that pull down lat based movement where you can get the best range to take that arm from overhead and bring it down close to the torso and elbow to the hip.
Yeah, and you'll see a lot of that commonality across the program designer and AHO as well, where you know we kind of map out all those splits for people who need that. You'll see that in that back specialization section is a lot of lat work on the forefront of a lot of these sessions.
Yeah, it all matters. Like we do have more of an upper back bias pull down, which hits more of like Terry's major. Like that needs to be in there too. You want like plenty of horizontal row work as well, because that's still going to hit all those mid upper lat fibers that make up that big armpit piece of the lat, the widest point of the lat. So that combination of like, basically you want the elbow to have a different finish point for all these movements. And I see that error made. Sometimes someone goes to another movement and it's almost a repeat of the movement they just did. So I'd ask yourself, if you're going to do any type of back row pull, if your elbow is finishing in the exact same spot that you just did, it's probably very similar movement, and you might consider consolidating that volume down and just maybe just adding a few extra sets into the prior movement that you did.
Yeah, exercise variety doesn't necessitate a better back session. It's the volume spent in that angle of upper arm relative to torso for back fibers.
Yeah, and so I think probably leave it there around back. I mean, obviously there's a lot more to develop a back with erectors and traps, but around the X frame, like that's going to be a big priority piece. And if you program that right, a lot of the other body parts are going to fall in line as well.
Which brings us to delts. You can never have too much delt.
You really can't. I mean, I know there's guys who are like, delts are a strong body part, and that's okay. It's just you need to bring up more of the other body parts, but you still can make your delts bigger. Like, it's not going to take you away from them. It's like, so anyway, with programming, though, for delts, like, most of the front delt work is going to easily be handled by all the pressing work for chest. I just rarely limit doing overhead press work, just because most of the people that I work with, I just run into so many issues with like rotator cuff, and also like removing the chest piece from it. Like, most people are going to need that too. So I would prefer to just do a steeper high incline press. Like, we get some upper pec work, we still hit plenty of front delt, and we're not gaining much extra from just going directly overhead. For a lot of people, that just might be limiting the range of motion. That might have application around females, though. But with that said, usually front delt work, isolation work doesn't need to be in place. My next priority point would be looking at the side delt. And that being one where you're not getting a lot of stimulus from any particular movement. Some people are like, oh, my behind the head shoulder press will hit the lateral head. Like, man, if you looked at fiber arrangement, like, it's really limited way how the side delt's getting trained to a substantial degree. So we're pretty much only looking at lateral raise movements here for side delt work. And I see where that could get pretty limited. Or you see a ton of work on one day. And they could handle it. But I would say it's probably more ideal to at least spread that out to two sessions for the week for your lateral raise work. Because once you do a lateral raise, how many variations does that muscle need to get fully trained? It's not like the back where, you know, this one movement will have like some lower lat fiber, then another one, maybe some more mid upper lat fiber. The lateral, just the side delt pretty much does one thing. So once you fully taxed out one movement, what else are you doing going to your next movement of doing a lateral machine raise, then to a dumbbell raise or a cable raise? So I would say fully tax it within that movement pattern. And then from there, head it again another day. I think that's where the frequency component could really shine for side delts.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that kind of brings us to, because you can get into lateral delt, like making sure execution's good, but that's all covered within like AHO, kind of outside the programming perspective. I do tend to lean towards, the only advantage I'll give in a lateral raise variation is a machine lateral that fits someone loading the elbow can help people kind of avoid the elbow issues that can come with high lateral work. So I will a lot of times lean on that fairly heavily, but that's the only add-on point I would give from the programming side to the lateral delt. Would you agree with that? Like, do you see that as well?
Yeah, with my tennis elbow, it's it might be a limiting factor for you with all like just the work that we do. So that, or even using like cable cuff work on the wrist, could offset a little bit. I saw even one guy using a cable cuff like on the actual upper arm to limit, because he's like, man, my bottleneck is like wrist hand issues. So you could do some work like that even if you don't have a lateral raise machine. But yeah, that would be the main component. And programming it, I would preferentially lean to putting your side delt work the first in your push sessions. If you're doing push sessions, otherwise, even in a pull session, I think it would be acceptable if you're doing side delt work there. It's not really going to limit any of your other work. And that's kind of my considerations. Like, is that going to limit the rest of my session to a great degree? And it's, you know, based on your needs as well. So if you had massive delts, we'll just put it later on in the session. But for a lot of us with wimpy delts, we would want it in the beginning.
Yeah, I think. And then you kind of get into rear delts and like the age old question of rear delts with back or rear delts with delts.
Yeah. That is a good question.
I tend to lean towards rear delts with delts because the quality of the stimulus is higher.
You said rear delts with delts.
Yeah, like with push instead of.
Oh, with push. Okay.
So like the reason I lean towards rear delts with a push-ish session or whatever you want to call it, it's from an output standpoint, I find output's quite a bit higher because you're not coming into the rear delt work with fatigue from all the back work. And I honestly just don't see sore rear delts affecting a back session.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I personally do them at the end of the pull session, but it's a needs thing and also like connection thing. But I would think, I remember the first time I trained rear delts first in a session was one of John Meadows' programs. And he's like, train them first before you do any of your pressing work. For what he had like some shoulder health, I think, things around this. But he's like, your rear delts create all that 3D look in all your side shots. Even from your front shots, it'll like your front lat spread, you'll see some side delt roundness like even within that shot. And the first time I did that, oh my gosh, my delts, like, they responded so well. It didn't take away anything from my pressing either. So you absolutely could do that sequence, right? Like, rear delt, side delt, and then move on to your press work from there.
Yeah. And if you have Yeah, if you have injuries with pressing, I'd maybe watch it because it could potentially affect like that eccentric a bit. But yeah, that'd be the only caveat.
Yeah, you're right. Like I've never, you worry about doing rear delt work right the next day going into a pull session because there would accumulate some more fatigue. And are they running into a point where you're just dumping fatigue on top of like what you're trying to recover from and not getting the best stimulus that way? They have pretty fast recoverability. So, something consideration point. It just depends, I think, how your overall split might look. You know, if you actually are doing pull after push session, for a lot of people, you might be running pull, then push, then legs, and that would be perfectly fine. I think that's even a nicer option. Do all your pull work. Rear delts don't get like this awesome stimulus necessarily. Then you can hit some extra isolation work the next day.
I think that's it. I think that covers it. I mean, it's not overcomplicating it too much outside of the execution stuff.
Yeah, that's it. We'll wrap it up there, guys. That is the main components of building your X frame for us all to look like Derek Lunsford. Okay, maybe not. But we're going to do our best. We'll do our best. Anyway, thank you all for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next time.